Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known purely for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together. Much of the time you think of a social a network. Nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. It puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, and maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the further you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the limit and you go to a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you so very much for bringing us through this disclaimer. Real succinctly, what he just said is that no one on this call in any way, shape, or form is able to give legal advice or financial advice. No one here is a member of the bar, an attorney, a judge, or is an officer of the court. What you have here is what Jefferson said is someone who is, quote, knowledgeable in the law and well-disposed to using it. There is some housekeeping I need to take care of. There are several people here that are first-time callers. You've gone through the disclaimer. I need to make a check mark against this phone number and hopefully a first name that you'll provide for me. I've been doing this marketing for almost 30 years with information providers. As I've watched others who do what I do become indicted, go to trial, and then go to jail because their disclaimers were either poorly written or inadequate. I feel like mine is ridiculous overkill, and I've been told that by many, but at the same time, I've never had a conversation with a prosecutor, a state attorney, or whatever. So it stays. Anyways, if you allow me, I'm going to unmute your phone, identify you by the last four digits of your phone number and the state you're in, and ask that you just simply give me your first name. If you don't want to give me your first name, make up a name. I don't care. So the first question is for Texas, caller ending in 9751, please.
Yes, that's me. This is Carlos.
Carlos. Thank you,
yes,
Carlos.
Sir.
All right. What happened? Give me a second. There we go. Next would be Leonardtown, Maryland, ending in 8666, please. First name only.
Stephanie.
Stephanie. Thank you, Stephanie. I appreciate
you're welcome.
You. Next is Asheville, North Carolina. I'm just going to take a wild guess and say this is JR. Is this JR? Ending in 9067? Hello, Asheville, North Carolina. Ending in 9067. May I have your first name only, please? We'll come back to you. Last is Philadelphia, PA, ending in 1620.
Susan.
Cruising for a bruising, Susan. That's an old song, old saying. Thank you very much, Susan. We'll go back to North Carolina real quickly. Ending in 9067, may I have just your first name only, please?
James.
I'm sorry? Can you repeat that?
James.
Thank you, James.
James.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Most excellent. All right. Now let me give you an introduction. These are things that you really need to think about. In addressing matters of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution, James Madison said in the Federalist Papers, number 39, and I quote, this is now January 26, 1788, referring to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, he said, its jurisdiction extends to certain enumerated objects only and leaves to the several states a residuary and inviolable sovereignty over all other objects. 85 years later, nearly immediately following our Civil War, in United States versus Anthony, this is 24 Fed 829, this is an 1873 decision, quote, the term resident and citizen of the United States is distinguished, meaning it's a separately defined thing, from a citizen of one of the several states, in that the former is a special class of citizen created by Congress. All right. To clarify further, the several United States are considered foreign to each other, except in regards to their relations as a common member of the Union. The term foreign nations, as used in a statement of the rule that laws of foreign nations should be proved in a certain manner, should be considered to mean all nations and states other than that in which the action is brought. And hence, one state of the Union is foreign to another, in that sense of the rule. And a recent federal statute proves that the Congress still refers to the 50 states as countries. When a state court in Alaska needed a federal judge to handle a case overload, the Congress amended Title 28 to make that possible. In its reference to the 50 states, the statute is titled the, quote, Assignment of Judge to Courts of the Freely Associated Compact States, end quote. Then the Congress refers to these freely associated compact states as countries. Reference in subsection B, it says, the Congress consents to the acceptance and the retention by any judge so authorized of reimbursement from the countries referred to in subsection A. So when the state of Alaska in 1959 translated from being a territory of the United States into one of the freely associated compact states, this delineation was clearly separated and identified. Now, the bad news is everyone on this call, unless proven otherwise, is deemed to be a federal citizen on a federal territory. If you're from Georgia, you're a Georgian. But if you're from the state of Georgia, you're a federal citizen because the state of Georgia is part of Title I, Article I, Section 8, Clause 17, versus Georgia, a state within the freely associated compact states, is one of the original entities. And that works with every state in the Union. So understanding these differences which clearly PJ does, and the people who have been listening to us talk about this for a long time, this clearly puts us in a place where we have something to argue about, something to deal with in legal matters. Because when the blue light goes on in your rearview mirror, when the policeman stops you on the sidewalk, when you get an indictment for an alleged crime, all of this is under the aegis that you are a federal citizen, which truly has no rights from the Almighty One, but simply has privileges extended by the Congress as federal citizens. And this difference is is the difference between them being able to come against you and not. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to PJ and let him explain it to you. Mansplain it to us, PJ.
Yeah, I have a new headset sound. Can you hear me, Michael? Michael.
I hear you. Yes, I hear you just fine. I muted myself
out.
But no, I muted you before because there was a wind noise and background noise. No, this is great.
Yeah, I'm on the yacht, so I got to tie this tarp down so it don't blow away. But you mentioned that I'm going to go in the wind a little bit, so bear with me for just a moment. You mentioned that the, for example, Nebraska or Texas or Alabama is an entity. I don't think it is an entity. I think it's just a area of land where people congregate. So you might want to be careful about calling it. Hold on, I'm just about to get this wind coming up. And it's starting to
pop. That's not acceptable. You need to go back into shelter.
Yeah, I'm going back down now. I got it tied down. These tarps on these things cost like $1,000. And we don't want it ripping.
And we just lost him. So what I'll do is add him in. If I can do that. Stand by, folks. No, he's calling back in on his own, so. Let me just continue while we wait for him to show up. I'm going to read you some court cases.
I'm back. Yeah? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
But go ahead
fine.
And read your court cases. Okay.
No.
I think I accidentally pushed the button and hung it up. So go ahead.
Okay. No, it's all right. Go ahead and work off of what we got.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about, I don't think, this, I was born and raised in Nebraska. So, but anyway, haven't been there for a long time. But anyway, I think Nebraska is not technically an entity. I think it's an area that people have called where specific men have occupied. It's not. I don't think it's an entity. Now the state of Nebraska is definitely an entity. So, but anyway, it might be a technicality they could use against you if you said that in court. But that's why you don't want to say much in court, because it's so easy for even an expert to say the wrong thing, and the judge, who is a professional trickster, will grab that and proceed with the case. It's very interesting. The United States written laws are in my research are entirely have a nexus with land jurisdiction. Even when let's say you're born in Mexico and you come up here and you raise your right hand, you become a United States citizen. They tie you into a land jurisdiction by recording your your domicile as the District of Columbia perpetually, no matter where you live in America, in Nebraska, or in the state of Nebraska, or anywhere in the world. If you live on the moon, they would probably, they would still domicile you as in the District of Columbia, because that is the land nexus that they rely upon to have jurisdiction over you, and are allowed to treat you as a legal fiction and make you subject to all federal and state legislative written laws. So, and I've never found an exception. Every time I've researched something, marriage license, driver's license, fishing license, medical license, everything has a portion in it that designates it to a land jurisdiction. So if you ever get a parking ticket or a federal indictment, contact us and we'll help you work through forcing them to produce the land jurisdiction. Can you still hear me, Michael? I want to make sure I'm still online.
Yes, you're fine. I mute myself
okay.
Out, so it always takes me a second or two to get back. You're fine.
Yeah. I just want to make sure because, you know, since the phone hung up there earlier. Ask me a question, Michael, that's pretty prominent in the people listening right now, and I can dive straight into it. Do you have one on the top of your head?
As simple as traffic tickets are as complex as IRS cases, they both are founded upon the same question, jurisdiction. And what I shared regarding the founding fathers, Madison, what I shared regarding a court case 85 years later, it's very clear that you have all questions founding upon what land jurisdiction did this event take place on, and what was the personam jurisdiction of the person or the people that is being talked to. So
exactly. Yeah, let's elaborate on that then some more, and ask questions as you go along, so that I can kind of because you know your client, your listeners far better than I do. Anytime an officer pulls you over and asks for license, registration, insurance, you can just hand them a piece of paper that has your full name on it. Don't use any aliases. And if you use an alias, write it as an alias and then give the name that you were called by your parents. And give them the date of birth, because they need that to divide you between all the other Michael Edwards in the world, because there's a lot of them. I can guarantee you there's more than just one. Give them a mailing location where they can stay in contact with you. Those are that's the only thing you have to provide them. And then after you do that, then just politely ask them if their employer owns the land that he's enforcing the claim to law that he's relying upon right at that point. Now most officers will just laugh it off in a sense, but there's a lot more officers out there than you would expect that listen to shows like this and the many others out there that are educating people on the limitations of the United States. So anytime the city, county, or state, if it's an unincorporated city, I don't know if they have a nexus with the United States, but most cities are incorporated, because as soon as anything starts rolling there, some lawyer shows up and says, oh man, do I have the benefits of incorporating which is licensed by the United States. And they've tricked the churches into doing that, deceived the churches into doing that. And believe it or not, in my experience, churches are the dumbest, the dumbest I just can't believe that an educated church board can adopt a 501c3 without investigating it. I mean, all you got to do is spend half an hour on the internet, and you'll find somebody that will explain to you the reason you have no requirement or advantage of getting a 501c3. You're already independent of the United States. Now, if you get a 501c3, you're no longer independent of the United States. They start governing you at that moment. And prior to that, they were only governing you based on deception, because they would show up, and there's usually a lawyer on every church board, major sized church, or there's a lawyer that's hired, retained, and then of course the elders listen to that lawyer more so than God. Or anybody else. Like Michael said, any of that land jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction. Now, the reason Michael makes a distinction on the difference between land jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction is, yeah, you can be in their land, and they still might not have personal jurisdiction over you. Now, they quite often do, but there's often situations where they do not have personal jurisdiction over you. Because if you're in their land and you're not a United States citizen, you have the right of passage. You don't have a right to pull over and set up a lemonade stand, but you have a right to passage. You have a right to pull over and get some hamburgers and a hotel and visit friends and conduct your nonprofit business. They don't have personal jurisdiction over you. But if you pull into their land and start selling lemonade along the road, or buy a business on their land and start other activities, or buy a house in their land, then there's a huge jurisdictional nexus being developed there. But only less than 25% of America is owned by the United States. So most of the time, when they come after somebody, they don't have any evidence that they can rely upon for land jurisdiction. And that has been very, very interesting with IRS cases that we're handling recently. We're challenging that. They do not allow a direct land jurisdiction challenge. So we've actually had several federal judges that passed away that helped an individual, or help put these briefs together that we rely upon to force them to produce that evidence in a roundabout way. It's been very successful, quite interesting. And it's based on, you say, I don't have a right to make a living being a dentist, or some of them were dentists, some of them are chiropractors. At that location without being taxed by the federal government. So we've been placing the burden of proof on them, and they've completely failed thus far. Very interesting. In the past, I figured that if you had a license from them, that you're automatically subject to producing a 1040 for them yearly and paying taxes. But what I've discovered, it might be true, I can't say it is true for sure, but of course, the IRS has to prove that, and the United States has to prove it, that the only place that dentistry license operates is in their land, as far as taxability. So, if you're not in their land and you're acting as your chosen profession is a dentist, you can require them to produce evidence that you have to produce a 1040 tax form. Now, if you don't produce a 1040 tax form and they don't produce any evidence that you're required to, then at least they have to produce a proper form to submit to you under penalties of perjury for a tax. And thus far, they haven't done this in some of our cases that we're running. And I don't know how it's going to end, but it's a big, big question. It's some of the lawyers that we work with have told us that it's probably the most essential question that's ever been posed to the IRS in the last 70 years. So now that same jurisdictional challenge operates on every written law of the United States, every city code that is operating under United States jurisdiction, every municipal code, traffic, housing codes, zoning codes, everything. If they have land jurisdiction, their written laws apply. If they do not have jurisdiction, then the general jurisdiction kicks in, which is the people that live in that area. And if somebody disagrees with you building a house somewhere, they can't run to the United States courts and put a stop to it. They have to convene a common law Seventh Amendment proceeding and get 3, 6, or 12 people to agree with them in a majority fashion before they can get a court order or a common law judgment against you. So, which is very interesting because a lot of the things that the United States does to us, your jury of 12 of your neighbors would never do it to you. Any questions popping up, Michael?
Well, let's tell them how to do that. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2 to raise your hand. And when you do that, I will unmute your phone and you are free to exchange with PJ. Let me check Freedoms Radio to see if anybody has asked a question there. Nope. So, if you'd like
okay,
to
I'll just
on.
Talk a little bit. I'll talk a little bit about property. You know, what's one of the major things that you know affect people's lives? And we've talked about federal taxes, and state taxes are hinged off of federal. If you don't owe a federal tax, you can't owe a state tax. They don't want anybody to know that, but that's the way it is. Because it's the same jurisdiction, same written laws that they're relying upon for both taxes. Property taxes is the same thing. If you own land in their land, you do not own it as ultimate title. You only have a ownership of use, and that use is predicated on you paying a fee yearly that. The commissioners get together or somebody figures out the levy on property taxes. And the assessor goes out and sees that your house is worth $100,000 or $1 million, and they times it by quite often 1.5% to 2.5% and send you a tax for that amount, which is oftentimes a monthly payment bigger than your original purchase price. And that's called property taxes. Now, they have a right to do that proprietarily if they have an ownership interest in the land. If they do not have an ownership interest in the land, then you have the ultimate taxing authority, and they do not. What that means is if they want to come on your property and do something, you can send them a contractual agreement for a fee, exactly what they do to you. So if they want to come on your property and impose municipal codes or things like that, send them a letter for land use and make it about $1 million a month, and they probably won't bother you. But anyway, you can have fun with that sometimes. So right now we've got several pieces of land out there that we're challenging them to produce right for taxation. A lot of these taxing situations, they just plow through and they tell you to pay a tax, and then another year goes by, they tell you to pay a tax, and another year goes by, they tell you to pay a tax, and then they sell the tax certificate claim to another party, and that party thinks you're going to get 14% interest off of it. And then I think it's a year and a half later, sometimes it's 3.5 years later, they can go in and foreclose and take that house for the taxes that are due. And now they can do that in their world, in their land jurisdiction, but they cannot do that if they don't have absolute taxing authority by ownership
which most of the time they don't. So that's going to be quite interesting. A lot of taxes go to property taxes, which ultimately goes to public schools, that ultimately go to controlling the education of your children. Boy, they get 8 hours of education 5 days a week, and you got to talk to your kids. A lot of families only talk to their kids 5 or 10 minutes a day, which is so wonder they grow up to be good citizens of the United States because they don't know anything else. I would love to walk into a school and just have a couple hours with them and explain to them how they can simply use these forms to ask if they owe a property tax or a federal tax or a state tax every time somebody comes forward and asks them to pay a tax or a traffic citation or a parking ticket, anything to do with that these generally pulled into a U.S. Court. There's a reason that flag is being flown in that U.S. court, because by law they must do that in a U.S. court. If it's a common law court, they could probably still have the U.S. flag being flown there, but it's only for decoration. It's not for a sign of jurisdiction. Now, recently, I've got several cases going now. We used to try to organize common law court actions completely independent of the so-called rooms that they call United States courtrooms. So what we're going to do now is we're going to go into the United States courtroom and inform them that that courtroom is actually the people's courtroom, and the people wish to run a Seventh Amendment court action there. And if they want to, they can provide an individual as a referee and not as a presiding judge. And they can bring in a person to record it that we can pay that person's fees. And we can proceed with a Seventh Amendment court action of a jury of 3 or 6 or 12. If it's a big issue, you better have 12 people there. If it's a small issue, just go with 3. And if you want to, if the other party agrees to it, you can go with 1 person as the judge. So, in a sense, the jury. So, but anyway, that's something you have to agree to at the beginning of the proceeding. I mean, if it's only a lawnmower issue and a $20 bill issue, I don't think you want to disturb 12 people and have them come in and have a jury for that. So, any questions popping up, Michael? If not, why don't you dig up one for off the top of your head? If I was listening to this program, I don't care if I listen to it every week for 20 years, I'd still have a question. I love this stuff. Go ahead.
No, actually, nobody has raised their hands. Press star 2 on your keypad, and here we go with Shelley. Thank you, Miss Shelley, for rescuing me so that I have someone to talk to.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
I can hear you.
Okay.
We're excited. We're excited. A question's coming. Good.
Well, I was curious about the 25% of the land that they do own. Where is that?
Well, if you live in Connecticut, it's only 0.4%. If you live in Nebraska, I think it's 1.5% or something. If you live in Nevada, it's 84%. If you live in California, it's 34%. So it's different. Now, if you want to know if they own your land or some land that you're considering purchasing, you can go to the Bureau of Land Management, Black Lives Matters. It's the same acronym. Bureau of Land Management.
Hey.
Everybody tells me, do you agree with BLM? I said, what's Bureau of Land Management have to do with this? they look at me like, what are you talking about? And I Google it and show them. But you can go to the Bureau of Land Management and ask them.
those guys are excited. Mm-hmm. They don't get that many people coming in there. I remember working with this Bureau of Land Management guy, and I started explaining to him some of my theories, and he says, you're right. He says, you know, he basically communicated, nobody knows this stuff. Nobody knows it. Or if they do know it, they're not allowed to talk about it. He says, this is crazy. And he said that, if there's not a land patent, not all areas of America are under land patent rules because they were established at different times in history, but most of it is. He says, if there's a piece of land and there's no land patent on it, the United States still owns it. So, and another guy told me, he says, like when Walmart goes in and buys a whole square block or something, they make sure they have a land patent on every square inch of that area, because if they don't, I mean, not that they have a land patent, but there's evidence of a land patent in the initial, that's the first chain link in the chain of title in America. Because if not, the United States still owns it, no matter what paperwork is laying in front of you, as far as a conveyance of deed and warranty deed and quitclaim deed and all that stuff. So that's how you do it. There's areas that it's very hard to get away from their land, and there's other areas that's very hard to find their land. So which territorial piece of... Now, Michael, when I say the word Nebraska, what is that? Is that, that's not a territory, is
that
it?
Is one of the several states within... That's one of the several states within the freely associated compact states.
Okay, so now when you look at the statutes, it talks about a state within a state. So Nebraska would be one of the freely compact states.
One of the freely,
and then there's a
freely associated compact states.
Freely,
the state of Nebraska. The state of Nebraska came into existence with the Buck Act of 1940, where the federal government, where the Congress overlaid the entire map of the United States and named the areas, the geographical boundaries, the state of Nebraska as a territory of the United States. So when you have the state of whatever, you know that that's talking about federal land. And if you want to see a map of this, just simply use your search engine and type in federal land map. I just pulled it up.
Right.
And
that's basically your BLM map. Now, when you look at the statutes, occasionally they'll say a state within a state. So what they're talking about is you have Nebraska, and then there's what states within that state? Well, it's the federal zones, the federal islands, the federal enclaves. They name them different things so it's confusing to people. They do this on purpose. They don't want people to know the limitations of their land jurisdiction, because they would be shrunk way down to a constitutional size. They would get far, far less money, and they would they'd have to work for a living. So, does that
gosh,
help answer
quickly?
Does that help answer your question?
They can't.
Yes.
Yes,
and I'm not a BLM member, so.
Okay. Yeah. Well. Black, white, green, orange, yellow, lives matter to me too, and white. Thanks for the question. Next question out there.
Shelley, did you have any follow-up questions?
No, thank you. Nothing I can think of at this time.
I appreciate you very much, Shelley. Thank you so much. All right, next is Norman. Go ahead, buddy.
Hey there. PJ, when you talk about the Seventh Amendment, you go in, you're just asking for the court to create a jury for whatever you're going to discuss. Is that right?
No.
Yeah, basically. There was an individual out of California. He still might do it, but he was older. He might have passed away now. Richard McDonald, I think, was his name. And he would require a Seventh Amendment common law court if they came after him on traffic tickets, and they would dismiss the cases. And he would basically go in and he'd put in the requirement for
he lay out why the requirement is afforded to him. And what it represented is the presiding judge is actually a referee. He can't interfere with the evidence going to the jury. He can't instruct the jury. He's there just to make sure there's plenty to keep the coffee pot full in front of him and that there's a fair trial as the best he can. And then you're just like any other referee on a field, but you know, he's going to have a lot of, he can't kick people out of the game. Only the jury can do that. But the, one of the interesting things that Michael, what was the name that I just said, that guy? But one of the things he...
Richard McDonald.
Have you guys heard of that name before?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He was a heck of a researcher. He did too much research. He got so much into research, he didn't get much done. But he would require the jury selection not to be United States citizens. And when the judge heard that, they go, "Oh, we don't want nobody know that, man. That's opening a big can of worms. We let people start selecting juries because they're juries that are not United States citizens, because people would start asking, well, what are you talking about? We're all United States citizens." And they don't want that being played out, because if Michael was, say, had a speeding ticket and Michael started interviewing the jury that was standing in front of him, the first question he would probably ask is, hey, Jill, are you a U.S. citizen? And Jill would say, yes, 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 I'm born in America. And then he would say, well, you can't have U.S. citizens she's not a U.S. citizen, but she says she is. So he'd bump her. And then the next person would get up there. And after about 70 or 80, 100 people being dismissed because they claimed that they're United States citizens, the state would give up on prosecuting Michael and say, you can go home, Michael. This is embarrassing.
Okay. It's not known by many people, but the term United States has been defined on two occasions by the Supreme Court of the United States. So it's well worth paying attention to what they say. This has also been written up in Black's Law, 6th edition, the Black's Law Dictionary, 6th edition. The first definition is, it may be merely the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to that of other sovereigns in the family of nations. Now, my grandfather, 8 times removed, Nathaniel, is listed in the Massachusetts militia as a, Minuteman, whatever, somebody to fight. He's a soldier in the Massachusetts militia. He fought against King George III. The King George III, through the Treaty of Peace in Paris, or Treaty of Paris, whichever you prefer, said in his very first sentence that his former colonists, his former enemy combatants, were his peer. His peer. What is peer to a king? Another king. Is a king sovereign? A king is sovereign. So he was identifying those people at that time as sovereigns, all of them. And by birthright, I enjoy the same status. And I can give you a court case, 2 of them, 3 of them. They're slaughterhouse cases is how they've grouped them. And you'll hear nothing but ridicule from the bench when you start bringing up the slaughterhouse cases. And as much ridicule you get, you can just simply smile and say, well, Your Honor, have any of these been overturned? The answer is no. So it may be the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous. That would be me. And anyone else like me who can trace their birthright, their birth, their lineage back to just before the war was written. You're making a lot of noise, PJ.
Yeah, I'm cranking on my... I'm stuck on a sandbar. I'm trying to get off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll mute you out for right now. The second designation is it may designate the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. This is who everybody thinks you are. This is who everybody thinks they are. And this is how they prosecute you to the hilt, because this is the territory which the sovereignty of the United States extends is federal territory and only federal territory. And if I were to ask you, you know, say you're from Georgia, are you a federal citizen? No, I'm a Georgian. Well, they're going to put words in your mouth or ask you questions uniquely and specifically that will draw you in to confessing you're a federal citizen. They might say, what is your residence? Is your residence 123 Main Street? You go, yeah, that's my residence. Right there, you confessed. If you remember at the opening of my talk, my introduction to bring PJ in, that was a key phrase that they used, was that they provided residency within the several states. Then the third definition, which is what you truly are if you aren't blessed with the birthright of having your ancestors having been on the ground at the time of the revolution with England, it may be the collective names of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. So those are three definitions. If somebody asks you a United States citizen, if somebody asked me if I were a United States citizen, I would say, well, sir, ma'am, you'll have to stipulate which definition you're in reference to. That's my reply. And on the other hand, PJ's reply would be, I have no evidence in my possession that I ever became a United States citizen. So, anyways, you could say both, actually. So, I just wanted to share that because it's critical in everything. If you are involved in any litigation whatsoever, they've made the assertion, when the blue light goes on in your rearview mirror, that officer made the assertion, there is a premise in law that says, it's a maxim in law, that says, one who asserts upon challenge must evidence their assertion. If unable to do so, the assertion is invalid. Simple as that. So any paperwork that PJ would be working with you on is immediately going to go to the assertion that they've made. Jurisdiction can be challenged at any time. It can be challenged before, during, and 20 years later. Doesn't matter. Anyways, let me unmute PJ here. Go ahead, PJ.
Yep, they have to prove jurisdiction. Now, remember, Michael said, if challenged. Now, if you don't challenge it, and they are breathing hard because we got seven anchors in the water trying to pull this 60,000-pound boat off this sandbar. I stuck it on accidentally. Got to move it foot by foot every time I wave.
They have schools for captaining boats, you know.
Well, I just got too close to the side. But anyway, yes, after you get into law, most people don't even think about this. They just read a complaint like, yeah, it's the same complaint I've read for the last 50 years from people, and they don't realize that in that complaint, when it's written by the United States, especially, they've got like 3 points in there on jurisdiction. They'll say that you're a United States citizen, that you're a resident. They'll put the address in there, but the city, the county, and the state, and the United States. And they're just roping you in all kinds of different ways as evidence of jurisdiction, that the United States court has authority to apply, to administrate that activity, that person. The judge says, okay, that's good. That's all I need. Let's roll. Let's put this guy away. And that's what they do. They rape you financially, and then they put you in jail and keep you to be a good behaving individual, which they like to call a United States citizen. It's just organized crime.
Did you have any other questions, Norman?
Yeah, kind of a follow-up on what you said, Michael. So when you ask the question, you answer them like you said, well, I have no evidence that I'm a U.S. citizen, and they come back, the judge comes back and says, well, don't you have residence at 333 Main Street?
I have no evidence that I have residence at 333 Main Street.
But how are you lying if you, in fact, do live there?
I then put my fingers up to my neck where I can feel my pulse. I take a deep, dramatic breath and say, Your Honor, I am pleased to share with you that I live where I stand. I've said that in court.
Yeah, well, that's not the issue. They're trying to associate. When you look up resident in the United States statute, it means a federal zone. That's what resident means in a U.S. court, may it be small claims, county, district, appeals court, state supreme court, or the United States Supreme Court, or any of the federal courts. Resident means a federal zone.
So again, U.S. versus Anthony, 24 Fed 829. Quote, the term resident and citizen of the United States is distinguished from a citizen of one of the several states, in that the former is a special class of citizen created by Congress. Remember that. That's it in a nutshell.
Oh, they have to prove land jurisdiction. If the judge asks you where you live, it doesn't make where you live. They have to prove land jurisdiction. You don't have to prove anything. They have to prove it. So anyway, we'll help you along that way. If you ever get in a situation, we got documents that we can put together that let them know that they can't go down that alley because we got a challenge waiting for them. We bring it on, bring it on. That's what we say, bring it on.
In closing, PJ in Florida was in court. And there were challenges that PJ made with regards to jurisdiction. And what did one of the marshals tell you when it was over?
He said, I've been here. I can't remember if he said 9 years, but I know he said at least 8. He said, I've been here for 8 years as a U.S. marshal. I've attended every trial that goes to every trial. Because most cases don't go to trial. But he said, I've attended every trial, and you are the only person that I've ever seen prevail in the United States Northern District of Florida. The only person. And during the trial, they tried to get I and another defendant to give evidence that we are U.S. citizens. And both of us said, that we have no evidence in our possession that we elected to become a United States citizen. And I believe that you can tell by the expression on the federal prosecutor's face that, oh no, we got some big problems here. And that federal prosecutor, I found out later, that was the only case she's ever lost in her career. So it's extremely important to speak very little and think a lot before you say anything in the U.S. court. But our clients don't go to U.S. courts. Hardly ever do we ever end up in a U.S. court. We can bring these challenges on pre-trial. You have a right to challenge them on the evidence, subject matter jurisdiction, before you go into trial. You can challenge them subject matter jurisdiction before you go out and spend $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $50,000, $150,000 on a lawyer. You don't have to hire a lawyer to do this stuff. You can do it right up front. If they can't prove it, case dismissed. If they can prove it, they might want to hire a lawyer to help you. Okay? Now remember, I work with people across the country, a group of people that they've taken $30 billion of property off the state property tax rolls. They don't do that because they want to. They do it because they know
as a matter of law, they must. It's exciting times. Internet's bringing a lot of truth back into a lot of freedom back into our lives. Go ahead, Michael.
No, I was just going to say in closing that post-event. Now, for some of you, that's something called the Mike G event, and for others, it's the global currency reset, et cetera. But when that event takes place, we will be offering something that we refer to as the strategic withdrawal from the United States, which is preempting everything before it even comes to PJ's attention through you. And basically, in a nutshell, it changes your status that the federal government views you as. So we're going directly to the core, and there'll be a identification card from the government given to you. And when you get pulled over, you don't hand them a driver's license, proof of insurance, or registration. You hand them this card. They'll recognize it as a government-issued card. They'll go back to their computer. They'll swipe it through. And that reader will come up and say, do not detain. Do not investigate. Let them go. Or something to that effect. So that's what's on the horizon right after this. Ron came in with a question. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes, you were discussing maximum law. Another maxim is maximum of electing. You can only communicate paper to paper or person to person. You cannot communicate person to paper or paper to person.
Well, that's interesting. Can you send that to me?
I don't have it in writing.
Well, if you go into a court proceeding, you can request oral arguments.
No oral arguments.
Or you can request no oral arguments. I don't think you can ever demand no oral arguments. They always have a right to respond in written format, which is the same as saying no oral arguments. So oral arguments are a trap, and you're going into a debate with a statist that has control of the microphone, and as soon as you get on the truth, he's going to pull the microphone away from you. So you never want to end up in court, oral arguments. Okay, got to go.
All right. Thank you, PJ. Ron, or to the group, what I would say to the judge is something to the effect of, well, Your Honor, that's a very, very good question. I need to take a day or two or three to give you an informed response to that question. Would you mind putting that question in writing for me, and I'll get back to you in a few days. Simple as that. All right. I want to thank everybody for joining us this evening. It's been a good call. Let me check Freedom's Radio real quick just to make sure that nobody else there has written up. Nope. Okay. Thank you all for joining us tonight, and until next week, good night and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.